Lecture number 3, The True Nature of Existence. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. One time the Buddha addressed his disciples. He said, monks, it may be that ascetics belonging to other sects will ask you, what is the purpose of leading the spiritual life under the Buddha? If they asked you this question, what would you answer? The monks remained silent. Then the Buddha said, if they should ask you, what is the purpose of leading the spiritual life, the brahmacharya, under the Buddha, you should answer them, it is for the purpose of understanding things that should be fully understood that we lead the spiritual life under the Buddha. Then the Buddha said, and what are the things that should be fully understood? They are the 5 aggregates of clinging: material form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. These are the things that should be fully understood. It is for the full understanding of these things that we lead the spiritual life under the Buddha. From this incident, we can see that the path laid down by the Buddha is essentially a path of understanding. The understanding aimed at is not merely conceptual knowledge, accumulating information, bits and pieces of knowledge. Rather, it is insight, direct and immediate insight into the true nature of our existence. This understanding brings liberation, the release of the mind from all the bonds and fetters that hold it in bondage, and it issues in the end of suffering, the cessation of dukkha. In this statement, the Buddha also indicates what has to be fully understood, what has to be known. What we have to understand is the nature of our own existence, our own experience. That is, we have to understand the 5 aggregates, the basic components of our being. Our own experience is of all things that which lies closest to ourselves. Since it is through our own experience that we contact everything else. However, ordinarily, we do not understand our own experience. We don't even make the effort to understand it. We use our experience to contact other things, to know and enjoy the world of the 6 senses, the world of sight, sound, smells, tastes, touch sensations, and ideas. But the experiencing itself doesn't get examined. Thus, we continue to learn about everything except the instrument of knowledge. Yet it is just this experience of understanding that provides the key to wisdom. The method of the Buddha reverses this procedure. The Buddha offers us the Dhamma as a searchlight we can focus on our own experience, in order to understand it in correct perspective, yatha bhutam. To understand our experience, our existence, involves 2 steps. First, we have to look into the makeup of a being, to see what our existence consists of, to take it apart mentally, to see how it works, then to put it together again and see how it holds together. The second step is to examine our experience in order to discover its most pervasive features, the universal characteristics of phenomena. We'll take these 2 steps in turn. The first step requires that we treat our experience analytically. We have to dissect the person, the being, our own individuality. We have to dissect it into its factors. The Buddha reveals that what we are, our being, our personality, is a composite of five groups of factors, which are called the five aggregates of clinging. In Pali, the Panchupadana Khanda. These are called aggregates of clinging because they form the basis for clinging. Whatever we cling to can be found among the five aggregates, either material form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, or consciousness. These five function together as the instrument for our experience of the world. We cling to them as the instrument of experience in this life. And when they break down at death, through that same clinging, the desire for enjoyment and for existence, we bring into being a new set of aggregates, a new life, to continue our experience in another existence. Thus, we build up one set of aggregates after another, life after life, and in that way, we accumulate dukkha, the suffering of the round of samsara. The Buddha says that the five aggregates are to be fully understood. That is the truth of dukkha, the first noble truth. And the first noble truth, the function with regard to that truth, is to fully understand it. To bring suffering to an end, to win the freedom, the peace, the happiness of deliverance, we have to turn our attention around and see into the nature of the five aggregates. The five aggregates are our burden, but at the same time, they provide us with the indispensable soil of wisdom. In the last talk, we explained the five aggregates in a general way. This time, we are going to examine them in greater detail. Our treatments will be largely analytical, but throughout, it should be remembered that Buddhism pursues analysis, not for its own sake, not in order to accumulate data and information, but rather to lay bare the nature of our existence as a preliminary to direct insight. The term aggregate in Pali, khanda, means a collection, a heap of factors. Each of the five aggregates is called a khanda because each includes under itself many factors. A khanda is a category or a classification containing a whole set of phenomena that share a common characteristic. Between them, the five aggregates exhaust our psychophysical existence. Any event, any occurrence, any element in the mind-body process can be put into one of the five aggregates. There is nothing in the whole experiential process that lies outside the five aggregates. The first aggregate is the aggregate of material form, the rupa khanda. This aggregate includes all the material factors of existence, every type of material phenomenon. Most important, of course, is the body, the physical organism through which we experience the world. The Buddha analyzes the aggregate of material form into two basic subsets. First, there is the four primary elements. Then second, there are the secondary forms of matter. The four primary elements are called by the old mythological names: the earth element, the water element, the heat element, and the air element. But for Buddhism, these terms do not mean literally the natural earth, the water, fire, and air. Rather, they symbolize four behavioral properties of matter, properties common to all material phenomena, properties that every material body exhibits. The earth element is the property of expansion, the property by which a material body occupies space, has some degree of hardness or softness, resists pressure, and excludes other bodies from occupying the same space. The water element represents the property of cohesion. Because of this water element, material particles bind together and adhere to one another. The heat element is straightforward. This is the principle of heat by which all material phenomena possess some degree of heat. Even when a particular substance feels cold to us, that is only because it contains less heat than our own body. But every material body possesses some degree of heat, some amount of the heat element. Then the air element is the principle of oscillation, by reason of which all material particles are in a state of vibration. By reason of this, material bodies can exhibit motion. Now, all material phenomena, as we said, possess these four elements to some degree. What distinguishes them is the proportion in which the primary elements are combined. We discriminate the types of matter on the basis of the dominant element. Thus, we get solid bodies, liquids, gases, and forms of energy, depending on the proportions or the predominance of earth, water, heat, and air. But the four elements are present to some degree in every unit of matter. Besides the four primary elements, there are a number of secondary types of matter. Material forms which are derived from the primary. These are called upadaya rupa, derivative matter. The most important of these are the five sensory receptors, that is, the sensitive tissue of the five sense faculties, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body. The sensitive matter by reason of which the eye can receive light, the ear can receive sound, the nose smell, the tongue can receive taste, and the body can receive touch sensation. The first four sense data, that is, colors, sounds, smells, and tastes, those are also types of secondary matter. The touch sensations, those are provided by material form itself, by the primary elements themselves. Other types of secondary material form are the life faculty, the faculty which vitalizes the body and keeps it alive. Also included is the mental base, that is, the organs and nerve tissue which function as the supports for consciousness with its thought process. Now, this one aggregate of material form comprises the entire material side of existence. The mental side is distributed among the other four aggregates. The mind, for Buddhism, is not a simple unity, but a complex cooperative activity involving four types of factors: feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. First, we take the aggregate of feeling, the Vedanakhanda, the second of the five aggregates. Now, feeling is the mental factor that has the function of experiencing the flavor of the object, the affective quality of the object. There are three basic types of feeling. pleasant feeling, painful feeling, and neutral feeling. Feeling can further be subdivided by way of the sense faculty through which it originates. So we get feeling which arises by contact through the eye, through the ear, through the nose, through the tongue, through the body. Then also feeling which arises inwardly by contact of the mind with ideas and with images. That is the aggregate of feeling. The third aggregate is the aggregate of perception, the sanyakhanda. Perception is the mental act of grasping the distinguishing qualities of the object. Perception takes note of the object's features. It identifies, marks, notices. Perceptions occurring through the eye take note of color and shape. They make the mental note, that's blue, that's red, that's square, that's round. Perception occurring through the ear makes note of sound, a loud sound, a soft sound, high, low. Perception also notices and identifies objects and people. That's a book. That's a lamp. That's Jim. That's Sally. He has brown hair. He's tall, and so on. This is all the work of perception. And perception is divided into six categories by way of the sense object that it arises through. By way of the sense object that it takes note of. That is perception of forms, perception of sounds, perception of smells, perception of tastes, perception of tangibles, and then perception of ideas. The fourth aggregate is the aggregate of mental formations, the sankhara khanda. Mental formations, sankhara. This is a comprehensive group which includes a number of factors. In the Abhidhamma, 50 sankharas are distinguished. But of these, the most important is volition, or will, that is called chetana. This is the factor responsible for action, the mental factor which arouses us to act by way of body or speech, or the factor which impels and motivates thought. The aggregate of mental formations also includes all the different desires and emotions, and of special importance, it includes the factors called the wholesome and unwholesome roots. That is, the basic psychological roots of unwholesome actions, greed, hatred and delusion, and the basic roots of wholesome actions, that is, generosity, loving kindness, and wisdom. The first aggregate is the aggregate of consciousness, the vijnana khanda. Consciousness is the chief factor of mind, that is, it's the basic awareness of the object, the life of awareness, which makes all experience possible. And consciousness is divided into six types by way of its basis. There is eye consciousness, or visual consciousness. That is, the consciousness which arises through the eye, cognizing visible forms. Then there is ear consciousness, or hearing consciousness, which cognizes sound. There's nose consciousness, which cognizes smell. Tongue consciousness, which cognizes taste. Body consciousness, which cognizes tangibles, touch sensations. And then there's mind consciousness, or thought consciousness. And this type of consciousness, mind consciousness, can cognize the objects of the senses. That is, sight, sound, smells, taste, and touch sensations, and it also can deal with its own class of objects, ideas, concepts, images, abstract notions, and so on. Consciousness seems similar to perception, resembles it in certain ways, but the two perform different functions. Consciousness is the general awareness of the object, and perception is the specific factor which grasps the object's distinctive qualities. But all the four mental aggregates always exist together. They all depend upon one another. They're always invariably associated with each other. So whenever there is any experience of an object, at that moment there is present simultaneously a feeling, a perception, a whole cluster of mental formations, and then, of course, there is the fifth aggregate, consciousness, the light of awareness. So these are the five aggregates, and these five aggregates constitute what is called Sakaya, literally the existing body, the psychophysical organism, our personality, our individuality. Whatever we identify ourselves with, whatever we take to be I, myself, can be found within the five aggregates. Therefore, if we are to understand ourselves, what we have to understand are the five aggregates. Now, to fully understand the five aggregates means to see them as they really are. And this means to see them in terms of the three characteristics of existence. These three characteristics are first, impermanence, anicca; second, unsatisfactoriness or suffering, dukkha; and thirdly, selflessness, non-self, insubstantiality, anatta. The Buddha says, Tabe sankara anicca. All formations are impermanent. Sabe sankara dukkha. All formations are unsatisfactory. And sabe dhamma anatta. All phenomena, totally everything whatsoever, is not self. All formations, sankaras, formations are things which arise through causes and conditions. And everything that arises through causes and conditions, all compounded or formed phenomena, are impermanent and unsatisfactory. Then all phenomena, all dhammas, all actualities, are not self, egoless, without. Now, normally, we do not recognize the three characteristics. We do not see them, even though we might have experiences which disclose them. We don't see them in their full depth, in their full significance. And the reason why these three characteristics are so difficult to see is because the mind is ordinarily covered over by avijja. That is, by ignorance. Ignorance is a specific mental factor which covers over our minds, which has been covering over the minds of all sentient beings through beginningless time. It covers the minds of everyone but the fully enlightened ones, the Buddhas and the Arahants. Now, ignorance functions in two ways, one negative, the other positive. On the negative side, ignorance simply obstructs us from seeing things as they are. It throws up clouds of mental darkness. It conceals the true nature of phenomena so that we ignore the real marks of things. But ignorance also has another function, a positive function. That is, it creates in the mind certain appearances, illusions, which are called in Pali vipalasa, literally perversion. These perversions infest the entire process of consciousness. So that instead of seeing things as they really are, we see them in ways which are quite the opposite of the way they really are. That is why they're called perversions. They turn everything we become aware of upside down. The perversions operate at three levels: the level of perception, the level of thought, and the level of understanding. First of all, we perceive things in a distorted way. Then, building upon these distorted perceptions, the mind thinks about the percepts in a distorted way. Then, weaving these distorted thoughts together into a picture of the world, we interpret our experience in a distorted way. That is, we become subject to the perversion of views, to wrong understanding. Now, the Buddha teaches that these four perversions, or we should say, the Buddha mentions four perversions which occur at each of these three levels. The first is the perversion of regarding the unattractive as attractive. This refers especially to objects of sense enjoyment. Seeing the body as beautiful and attractive when the body is really a mass of skin, bones, organs, flesh, and blood. The second perversion is the perversion of regarding what is really dukkha as a source of true happiness, seeing what is unsatisfactory, insecure, connected with pain, seeing that as pleasurable. The third is the perversion of regarding the impermanent as permanent. And the fourth is the perversion of regarding what is really not self, not an ego, taking that to be our self, our ego. Each of these four perversions occurs at the three levels: perception, thinking, and views. And because of these distorted motions, our minds get caught up in the web of illusion. They give rise to craving, conceit, wrong views, and all the other defilements. And in that way, we become lost in dukkha, in suffering. The Buddha's teaching on the three universal marks of existence, impermanence, suffering, and selflessness, this gives us the remedy to clear away these delusions, the means to get free from suffering. The perversion of regarding the unattractive as attractive, this is limited to the body, and therefore its antidote, which is the meditation on the unattractive nature of the body, this is not really a universal characteristic, but is more limited in scope. The three universal characteristics are impermanence, suffering or unsatisfactoriness, and selflessness. And these three characteristics have to be understood in two stages. First, they have to be understood intellectually by reflection, by examination. Then, when we've understood them intellectually, then we have to penetrate them by direct experience, through direct insight. Now, intellectual understanding should not be confused with insight, and it shouldn't be made a substitute for it. The value of intellectual understanding is preliminary. It serves as a preparation for insight. But eventually, it has to give way to direct realization. And so when we explain these characteristics intellectually, we shouldn't make this a substitute for practice, but just use it as a guideline for understanding what has to be seen through the actual practice of insight meditation. Now we'll take these three characteristics in turn. The first characteristic is anicca, impermanence. This is the root characteristic in the Buddha's teaching, the characteristic which is the most fundamental, the one which forms a basis for the other two. Because of the characteristic of impermanence, we'll see that things become unsatisfactory and become egoless. The mark of impermanence has two aspects. One is gross, the other is subtle. The gross mark of impermanence is fairly evident, and we only have to attend to it in order for it to become clear. The teaching on gross impermanence makes it known that everything that arises must at some time pass away, that whatever comes into being must eventually pass out of being, that whatever is put together sometime comes apart. This is evident in the cosmic process, in the course of history, and in the course of our own lives. The Buddha teaches that the cosmic process goes through four stages of development. Every world system goes through four stages. First, it emerges from a state of undifferentiated matter. Then it evolves to a point of maximum differentiation. Then, thirdly, it begins to disintegrate. And fourthly, it goes to a stage of total disintegration, total destruction. Then, after some time, the process repeats itself over and over. And that way, every world system arises, evolves, and passes away. In history, we find the same pattern again. A civilization, an empire, arises, reaches its zenith, then it declines, and eventually it perishes. In some suttas, the Buddha sometimes describes ancient empires of the distant past, even long before his own time. He describes their capital cities, their rulers, their courts, their ministers, their populations. He shows them in all their glory, and then he points out that all of this has passed away. Then he draws the inevitable conclusion that all formations are impermanent, unstable, comfortless. It's enough to turn away from them, to become detached from them, enough to get free from them. In our own life also, we can see the mark of impermanence. We are born and grow up, and when growth reaches its maximum, it's followed by aging, decay, and death. And nothing in life is absolutely reliable. Our fortunes change, our interests, our characters, our relationships evolve and dissolve. Whatever built up comes apart. Whatever we gain eventually has to be lost, and the whole process of life eventually ends in death. That is the gross or coarse feature of impermanence. The subtle mark of impermanence is more difficult to grasp. This indicates not merely that everything produced eventually perishes, but that all being itself is really a process of becoming. It points out that there are no static entities persisting unchanged, but only dynamic processes which appear to us to be stable and static simply because our perception is not sharp enough to detect the changes. The things themselves are constantly undergoing change. just as a waterfall is always changing, but from a distance it seems solid because our perception can't pick up the flow of water. According to the Buddha, all formations, all momentary happenings, thing events, go through three stages. There are three sub-moments. There is a moment of arising, finally a moment of perishing, and between the two, there is a moment called Titassa Anyataka. That is the transformation of that which endures. And this intermediate mark, this means that even in the brief moment when a thing exists, it isn't static, but changing, a process, a flux of becoming. The stable entities that we see, conceive, and deal with, these are really bundles of events, packages of momentary flashing, strung together by our perception into a mass, in order to enable us to deal with the world, to get along in the world. Now, the Buddha's teaching on radical impermanence applies to all conditional things, all formations without exception. But it applies especially to our own personality, to the complex of the five aggregates. To the eye of insight, our entire being dissolves into a compound of conditioned factors subject to constant change, to change and transformation going on continuously without a break. First, take the aggregate of material form. The body is made up of minute groups of material phenomena, which are themselves actually streams of events arising and passing away with incredible speed of transformation. The change takes place so rapidly that the eye and mind cannot register it. If we twirl a glowing stick in the dark, the eyes fuse the moving point of light into the shape of a circle. Appears to be a solid circle of light. In the same way, material form is subject to a continual flux of becoming, arising and passing away thousands of times each second. But all these processes get fused together into the appearance of a solid body. But the stable, solid material body, that is actually a mental representation, not a reality. It is a mental image arising in the mind and superimposed on the streams of material events, giving rise to the perception of a stable material object. But through keen mindfulness and insight, the stable body dissolves, reveals itself to be just a collection of minute material processes arising and perishing from moment to moment. The same process of change applies to the mind. The mind is a composite of these four mental aggregates: feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. And these are all in process. Streams of events arising and perishing countless times each second. Every moment there's a new feeling arising and passing away, a new perception, new mental formations, a new consciousness. They seem to form a stable, lasting mind, but this is only an appearance caused by the continuity of the process. Actually, there is a succession of frames of mind, discrete acts of cognition made up of the four mental aggregates. processes exhibit the same structures, similar patterns, so there appears to be the lasting mind. But beneath the outer cover-up patterns, the factors themselves are always changing, arising and dissolving. If we pay careful attention to the mental process, we see the rise and fall of mental events. Attention to the rise and fall breaks up the appearance of continuity, reveals the differences between events, and the discrete nature of the mental factors. And that way we get to discover the subtle mark of impermanence of a nichitta. The second characteristic of existence is dukkha. In our last talk, we explained that dukkha means both felt pain and suffering and also the general unsatisfactoriness of conditioned existence. And here the general characteristic of unsatisfactoriness is intended as the meaning of dukkha. But the two aren't totally separate. A fundamental reason why existence is unsatisfactory is because it is connected with pain, subject to suffering. The pain and suffering to a great extent are rooted in impermanence. We crave for a world where everything that we value and love will remain forever, but it has to change. And when we meet this change, then we undergo suffering. The five aggregates themselves are impermanent. We would like to preserve them, to make them steady, to dominate them with our will, but they escape our grasp, and then we meet with dissatisfaction, with suffering. Our inability to control the very things that we take to be ourselves. The Visuddhimagga, the great commentary, says that dukkha has the meaning of oppression by rise and fall. Rise and fall is the feature of impermanence. The five aggregates are subject to constant rise and fall. When we contrast this rise and fall with our desire for peace, for stability, then the rise and fall of the process seems oppressive. Therefore, oppressiveness by rise and fall is the distinguishing feature of dukkha. Since we discussed the characteristic of dukkha in full detail in the last talk, we'll just treat it very briefly here. Now, the third characteristic of existence is anatta, selflessness, or non-self. And this is the deepest, most difficult of the three characteristics. So we'll give it more attention than the others. Now, in the teaching on anatta, the Buddha proclaims that there is nothing that we can identify as self, that all the things that we take to be ourselves, to be I and mine, that all of these are really not self. This teaching on anatta cuts very sharply against our ingrained patterns of thinking. Almost all of our thoughts, all our activities, all our concerns center around the ideas of I, mine, myself. Yet the Buddha holds that these notions are deceptive, delusions that lead us into trouble, conflict, and suffering. And he teaches further that in order to get free from dukkha in all of its forms, we have to break out of the clinging to the idea of self. And the only way to do that is to penetrate the mask of selflessness, anatta, to see with insight the selfless nature of all phenomena. The teaching on anatta can easily be misunderstood. To see the exact meaning of the teaching, we have to discriminate between what the teaching denies and what it doesn't deny. We can approach this discrimination by distinguishing the different meanings of the word self. The word anatta means literally not self. So what is the self that's denied in the teaching of anatta? The word self can be used in three senses. Firstly, it can be used with a reflexive meaning, as when we speak of myself, yourself, oneself. And the Buddha accepts this use of the word self. He says you have to train yourself, one must purify oneself, you have to make the effort yourself, and so on. That's a perfectly legitimate use of the word self. A second use is to refer to one's own person, to refer to the compound of body and mind. Here the word self or I is a shorthand device. It's used to refer easily and economically to what is really a complex process. In this sense, that the word self is also acceptable in Buddhism. We use it to distinguish different people. The third sense of self is that of a substantial ego entity, a lasting subject existing at the core